Much enjoyed the presentation.
Oh, thank you.
But I have a question about U.S. water rights. I
Okay.
think they're extremely effective, but very expensive.
So you mean Western water rights under the prior appropriation system?
Right. It's you've got to measure water all the time, and you got to go to court for any dispute. And that's a pretty expensive proposition.
It is a very expensive proposition, which is one of the reasons I liked working in Wyoming, is because you didn't have to deal with the court system there. You could get your permit from the state engineer, and it was an administrative board that adjudicated that permit. So you could do it yourself. You didn't have to have lawyers and engineers in when you did it. But that is a big downfall, I think, for our system, Dick.
As I have wandered through the third world water rights, I've often wondered if there wasn't something may not be quite as good, but more cost effective. Not that I have an answer to that, but I just think it should be possible.
Yeah, I think we could always do things better. But when you've got property rights protected by the Constitution under the system, it takes a lot to change that.
Yeah, I'm well aware of that. Anyway.
Well, and Dick, I don't know if you've been following the Waters of the United States conversation, but I did mention it 2 weeks ago where the definition of Waters of the United States has kind of gone back and forth with different administrations. And I just got off the lecture on Monday and got an email saying that a federal court had thrown out Trump's rule on that. So it continues to make the news.
Okay, anyway, I will turn myself on mute and enjoy the presentation.
Thanks, Dick. And welcome, everyone. This is Grad 592, Water Resources Graduate Seminar. To the students who are out there, I need you to keep your cameras on, please. It's good to see you. And I think you're going to enjoy the lecture today. We have a very interesting speaker, and she comes from the city of Fort Collins, and she is a CSU grad. So what more could we offer you than that? I did discover that I seem to sometimes miss some students who might have questions or comments. And so if I don't see your hand, put something in the chat, and the gals in the office will catch that and interrupt. Jill, they may interrupt you if there's a question that's relevant to what you're talking about. And so please feel free to do that. Also, a reminder to students and to those of you who are guests and joining us, we set out for every class, there's assigned reading. It's in Canvas, it's also on the website. And the point of that reading is to give you some background in some of the things we're going to be talking about. Some of them are as easy as newspaper articles, other of them are more in-depth peer review typed articles, but I try to give you a good selection of things to look at. So with that, let me introduce Jill, I don't even know how to say your last name.
Oropeza.
Oropeza, thank you. Jill is the Director of Water Quality Services at Fort Collins Utilities. And I've asked her here to talk a little bit about what Fort Collins does for water quality, sustainability. And Jill has also worked with Fort Collins on fire issues and watershed sustainability. So I've asked her to speak to all of that. And Jill, I'm going to turn it over to you. And thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Okay, let me get my screen shared here. Can everybody see that? Are we sharing?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for the introduction. And let me move this real quickly. Okay, ready to go. Thanks for your patience there. So the purpose for me presenting today is I'm going to give an overview of how we in Fort Collins Utilities manage and are impacted by water quality throughout the water utilities and our operations. So I'm going to go through at sort of a mid-level, not super in-depth, but talk about what we do and some of the related current and future challenges that we are working on. So with that, really, I want to point out that when we're thinking and working around our water quality objectives, we are striving first and foremost to meet all of the regulations that we are subject to, and then otherwise to protect and enhance the quality of water supplies that wherever and whenever that we are storing those waters, consuming, influencing, or returning it back to the river, whether it be through our raw water supplies, our treated water, our stormwater, wastewater, or our treated wastewater discharges. So conceptually, this touches on just that concept. These are the four primary areas of our utilities operations that I'm going to focus on today. And they really start at the top of our system in our source watersheds that deliver our raw or untreated water supplies. Then moving through our drinking water treatment and distribution system, our stormwater conveyance system, and then finally, our wastewater reclamation facilities where water is returned to the Poudre River. There are certainly a lot more examples that I'm going to touch on today across the city of the ways that we impact and work with water quality in mind, but most of those relate back to these core service areas. So I'm going to start at the top of the water system and talk first about our source watershed program. And if you did have a chance to look at the water quality report that was shared, that came out of this program. So there's two key functions of the watershed program. And the first is to provide water quality monitoring services. And then secondly, the focus on source water protection. But first, I'm going to step back just a little bit and give some background on our water supplies. So throughout the talk today, when I'm talking about source watersheds, I'm referring to watershed that supplies our untreated or raw water for treatment. The city water supplies originate from two primary sources. First is our Horsetooth Reservoir supply. Horsetooth Reservoir is a terminal reservoir in the Colorado Big Thompson system, which on the map here is shown in purple. The water supplies include water from the Colorado River on the western slope, which is transported to the eastern slope of the divide through the Adams Tunnel, where it commingles with the Big Thompson River and tributaries on the east slope, and as it's being transported on its way to Horsetooth Reservoir. Water in Horsetooth is released from the north end of the reservoir at the bottom of Soldier Canyon Dam, and almost directly to, there's a short pipeline that delivers it to our water treatment facility, which you'll see shown on the map with that red diamond. The city's Poudre water supply originates from the Upper Cache La Poudre watershed that's shown here in the lighter blue-green on this map. The water is withdrawn from the river at our water supply intake at Gateway Natural Area, which is shown by the yellow dot. And that's just above where the main stem of the river confluences with the North Fork of the Poudre. That water is then delivered to the water treatment facility via numerous miles of underground pipelines. So every year, about 50% of our water supply comes from each of these two sources. And what we do is we blend those waters for optimal treatment conditions and quality as it changes throughout the year. So at certain times, we might be taking more Horsetooth and lower Poudre ratio, but on an annual average, we take about half from each source. Within our source watersheds, the city owns less than 1% of our land, or 1% of the land area, but rather it's a mix of private, federal, and state ownership. And it should be noted that these two water source supply these two water sources supply water not just for the Fort Collins utilities, but also for surrounding communities in northern Colorado, and they also provide irrigation water to agricultural users in the area. So for Fort Collins, almost all management activities or monitoring that we do has to be done in collaboration with other water providers and agency partners. Okay, so back to the water watershed program. This program has two full-time employees and two seasonal employees. And the water monitoring programs that they execute demand almost all of their time to travel up into the watersheds. They're collecting the samples and they analyze and report the data in order to understand and communicate the longer-term trends in water quality. The monitoring programs that we have include our Upper Poudre Water Quality Collaborative Monitoring Program. It is a cost-shared program that Fort Collins manages, and it is cost-shared with the City of Greeley and the Tri-Districts. If you're not familiar, the Tri-Districts provide water for the surrounding communities outside of the core of Fort Collins utilities. They include East Larimer County, North Weld, and Fort Collins Loveland Water Districts. The monitoring program has 19 sites on the main stem in the North Fork of the Poudre, and we're out there 11 times a year from April to November collecting samples. And the purpose of this program is to track long-term trends in water quality and parameters of interest that are specific for water treatment operations. Secondly, we have our Halligan Reservoir Monitoring Program. This is a city-operated program to monitor water quality in Halligan Reservoir, which is situated on the North Fork of the Poudre. And that reservoir is currently in the permitting stages for expansion. So this water won't be treated directly for drinking water, but it'll be instead used for drought protection. And what that means is that the water can be exchanged for other downstream water rights on the main stem as needed. We, on Horsetooth Reservoir, we had a program in place for close to 20 years, but in 2015, we worked with Northern Water and came up with a partial cost sharing for monitoring Horsetooth Reservoir water quality. They currently do the monitoring work on the lake itself, and we provide the in-kind laboratory services. We also have a surveillance system that's installed on the river, and that provides real-time information at two different locations on the river. The data are visible via a web-based platform, and it enables alerts that can be programmed in to signal when we see changes in upstream water quality. So this really allows our water treatment operators to safely have enough lead time to shut off our supply lines in the event that water quality changes rapidly. And that enables them to bypass that poor quality water until the conditions improve. This system was put into place following the High Park Fire of 2012, when we first saw very rapid changes in water quality due to some of those post-fire ash and debris flows that occurred. In 2020, this last year, we expanded that system to include a site higher up in the watershed to capture the effects of the Cameron Peak Fire. This team of folks also works on special issues and studies that are related to such things as emerging contaminants, harmful algal bloom, and wildfire impacts.
Jill, sorry to interrupt. We have a question from Martha asking if you could please elaborate on the types of contaminants being measured.
I'm going to talk a little bit later specifically about emerging contaminants. What we monitor in our in the monitoring program itself is we're looking at chemical, physical, and biological constituents. So we're looking at kind of the physical measurements of how much oxygen, how much dissolved materials in the water, the pH, those kinds of things. Then we're looking at alkalinity, hardness, metals, nutrients, bacteriological things like E. coli, Giardia, Cryptosporidium, those types of things. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else. We also monitor for taste and odor compounds known as geosmin and MIB, which is methyl isoborneol. That's a those are compounds that affect not the safety of the water, but more in part kind of a bad taste and odor to the water that's pretty difficult to treat. Does that help answer some of that question? And I'll get to the emerging contaminants piece a little bit later. Does that help?
I'm impressed with your memory, Jill.
I was digging in
deep. No, I think that's good. I think that answers the question.
Yeah, she's okay. Thanks in the chat.
Okay. So I wanted to take just a minute to talk about the actual impacts of wildfires on water quality, because these kinds of post-fire changes demand such a significant amount of time and resources for us to manage. So as you may or may not know, there were two fires that happened in 2012, the Cameron Peak Fire, which impacted our Poudre water supply, and our East Troublesome Flat Fire, which affected the collection reservoirs on the western slope of the Colorado Big Thompson system. And if you recall, it's that Colorado Big Thompson system that fills Horse Tooth Reservoir. So having two high quality water supplies for Fort Collins is a major advantage in managing some of these post-fire impacts. As I also just mentioned, remember we can, when one is impacted, we can blend out some of those.
I think you're muted now.
Jill, you just muted yourself, or maybe it just
happened. I'm so sorry, that was my fault. I was trying to admit someone.
Oh, okay. So There's your feedback. All right.
Thanks. And sorry about that.
Okay. So we were talking about the two major fires, one on the Cameron Peak that affected our Poudre water supply and the East Troublesome Fire that impacted the collection reservoirs of the Colorado Big Thompson system. Those reservoirs do ultimately deliver water downstream to Horse Tooth Reservoir. And so I was saying that having those two high-quality water supplies is a major advantage for Fort Collins in that it enables us to manage those post-fire impacts or any other types of water quality events that occur. So essentially, again, it's that blending ability or the ability to switch entirely over to one source or another, depending on the quality of the other source. So in the situation where we've had fires in both of our delivery systems, the biggest risk is if we're to see degradation in both sources concurrently. For now, we've only seen some very temporary impacts to the Poudre River, and we haven't observed any impacts in Horse Tooth Reservoir, but it is something that we continue to monitor and coordinate with water, our Northern Water, very closely on. Some of the examples of potential post-fire water quality impacts on our water supplies and some of the treatment challenges are summarized in this table here on the right. What we are paying attention to are things like increased nutrients, turbidity, which is essentially a measure of what's in the water, suspended or dissolved, increases in total organic carbon or alkalinity, sediment, and hardness. And what those do is they translate to some very specific treatment-related challenges that you can see listed there. In particular, one challenge with the Cameron Peak Fire that was not present during the High Park Fire is that the areas, the burn areas surround several of our, well, not just ours, but other water providers' high mountain reservoirs. And we are concerned because those all drain into the Poudre and commingle on their way down to our water supply intake. We're concerned about the sedimentation and the nutrient loading that has potentially occurred into these reservoirs and will continue to occur over some time. Excess nutrient loading can lead to blue-green algae blooms, and some of those species of blue-green algae can release taste and odor compounds that I was mentioning. And then there's also a potential for cyanotoxins as well. So we're particularly concerned with impacts to the Poudre in the late summer and winter when the flows in the river are dominated by those upstream reservoir releases. So we've been collecting baseline reservoir water quality in 2012 and through this summer, and we're in the process of developing a reservoir water quality study with Matt Ross there at CSU and some other stakeholders. Okay, so I'm going to move a little bit away from monitoring and touch here on the second key function of the Watershed Program, which is our source water protection. Through planning and collaboration, this team works to identify and mitigate high priority threats to our source water quality. In many cases, this is happening through funding collaborative projects with local partners and agencies. Most of these types of projects are related to mitigating risks from wildfires through forest fuels management projects and implementing post-fire restoration projects like stream channel restoration and other erosion control measures. And then lastly, the team coordinates our spill response plan, which informs how the utilities engages and responds to the spill events. If you read the papers or listened to the news, you might know that we had a cement truck go into the river last Thursday, I believe. And that is a perfect example of a time where we pick up our spill response plan. We look at the time it takes any leaking contaminants to mobilize to our intake facility. That's based on how much water is in the river at a given time. And so we've done some mapping and some modeling to get time estimates for delivery of any contaminants. We prepare to shut off our intake and switch entirely over to our secondary source. And then it also provides us information on how we can assist and be in communication with state patrol, PFA, and any other first responders. And some of that, those types of activities would include deploying booms at strategic locations to capture any floating contaminants like fuel or things like that. So that's another really important function that happens often, more often than we would like. So I'm going to switch now and start talking about our drinking water treatment and distribution operations. The water treatment facility provides about 65 million gallons per day, depending on the season, for about 130,000 plus residential, commercial, and industrial customers. So once we divert that water from the river out of Horsetooth Reservoir, the nature and goals of our water quality monitoring shift to focusing on water treatment effectiveness. Water treatment operations are highly regulated by the Safe Drinking Water Act, and we have some very specific programs and goals that are focused on several factors. The first of which is turbidity removal. Removing turbidity or turbidity itself is a proxy for the presence of potential pathogens like E. coli or Giardia. We also have programs in place for corrosion control, and this sets targets and increases the alkalinity and the pH of our water to reduce any chemical corrosion potential between the water itself and the pipe materials that it travels through. And that ensures that metals like lead or copper don't accumulate in the drinking water. And then lastly, we take measures to ensure that the water is disinfected at the optimal level. And that's based on how much water demand there is within the system, what the organic matter content of the water is, and along with some other factors. And this prevents any potential growth pathogens as the water is traveling through the miles of the distribution system on the way to the customer's tap. So in order to ensure that the water quality is consistent from the time that it leaves the water treatment plant to when it reaches our customer's tap, we have a team of lab staff who monitor and analyze samples from across the distribution system on a weekly basis. So on average, we'll analyze between 120, 150 samples per month. And the types of things we're looking at are E. coli coliforms again, along with some other bacteriological parameters. We're looking at the amount of chlorine residual that's in the water. And then we're also looking at things like hardness, alkalinity, and on a more infrequent basis, we're looking at metals, again, to support that corrosion control program.
So Jill, you talked about lead and lead pipes. Do you have issues with that? Are you all considering replacing your lead pipes? Can you talk about that a little bit more?
I sure can. That's a really important topic for us. So the City of Fort Collins does not have any full lead service lines within our distribution system. We're very, very fortunate in that respect. What we do have are in a subset of our service area, which is primarily centered around the Old Town area. We have about 800 to 1,000 homes that are have galvanized service lines. And those lines are aging and cracking. So as they start to deteriorate, they can release metals. Lead is not necessarily one of those metals. But what we have found as we have our history of finding and replacing these broken lines is that those galvanized service lines actually, many of them are associated with having this 18-inch piece of lead pipe that's called a lead gooseneck. And that lead gooseneck connects it to the service line that goes from the main to the customer, to the customer's home. And so there's this flexible piece of the wire that makes that connection easier. And those were used prior to the 1950s. And so we do have some of those left in the system. And just given the nature of the material, we feel like it's the best thing to do to accelerate the removal of those. That work is not regulated or mandated by the EPA under any of our existing lead and copper rules or even proposed new rules. But we have decided that it's priority to us, and we have we've scoped the problem. We know the size and what it's going to take in order to replace those. And so currently we are undertaking the removal and replacement of those lead goosenecks and those galvanized service lines.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I was saying that we are out there in the distribution system doing a lot of testing. And all of those test results we send over to the Colorado Department of Health and Environment. And that ensures that we're meeting those regulatory requirements, but we're also exceeding the standards, which is more aligned with our goals.
Jill, we had a question on that last slide about Martha wanted to know what types of treatment are being used, and then said filtration, RO, chlorine, some combination.
Yeah, so the Fort Collins Water Treatment Facility employs what's called conventional treatment. So essentially what that is it's coagulation and flocculation. So coagulation is essentially where you add aluminum sulfate to the water, and that pulls the any dissolved particles out of the water and it forms larger particles. And then it goes through a flocculation cycle, which further increases the size of those particles and the density of them. And they actually sink out with gravity and are pulled off the bottom, and the clean water is decanted off the top. That clean water is then put through filters. We have anthracite coal is what we use to filter the water. And then the water goes through disinfection, and we use chlorine gas for disinfection. And it then goes into what's called our chlorine contact basin. It's just a serpentine style flow path that the water circulates in to ensure that all of the water has had adequate contact with chlorine. And then it's delivered into the distribution system. So we don't use any enhanced treatment like reverse osmosis or anything like that, or filtration or membrane filtration. Let's see, we talked about that. I'm going to move on there. So we have a water quality lab in-house at the water treatment facility. And this laboratory is state certified for the analysis of drinking water. We have five chemists that work there, two lab assistants, a lab supervisor, and then we have a two-person quality assurance team. We have found that maintaining an in-house laboratory provides cost benefit over outsourcing our analytical needs to contract labs. And it also provides us the flexibility and faster turnaround times that we need
to when we're encountering issues and exploring solutions. It provides us good operational flexibility there. Any questions about water treatment before I move on to stormwater? So moving on to stormwater quality, I'm going to talk specifically about our municipal separate storm sewer system, which from now on I'm going to refer to as the MS4 program because it's difficult to say. But in Fort Collins, as the name implies, our stormwater system is separate from our sewer or wastewater collection system. So that means that any drainage from our urban landscape drains directly to the Poudre River and is not intercepted by any sort of treatment facility. For systems like ours, the state issues what's called an MS4 permit. So as I was saying, the city's storm drainage system, it's designed to serve two purposes. The first is to prevent property flooding by directing any floodwaters into local creeks in the river. And then it also serves to protect those water bodies from pollutants that are commonly present in the urban environment. To minimize the pollutants that are transported by the stormwater runoff into the storm sewer system and then subsequently into the receiving waters, the city implements programs in accordance to its MS4 permit. And those program components include an illicit discharge detection and elimination program where we respond to reports of spills or illegal dumping and help with the cleanup of those. It includes construction site erosion controls where we have inspectors go out on to construction sites and help them set up their erosion control measures to keep that sediment from entering into the storm system. We have a lot of pollution prevention education. So we design education campaigns around things like how to properly dispose of waste, the importance of fixing leaks on your vehicles, and how to properly fertilize your lawn, those sorts of things. And then the last one listed here is we work to install and inspect low impact development features like rain gardens and pervious pavers. And those serve to collect and maximize the infiltration of runoff from the roofs, sidewalks, and roads. And if you are keen to learn more about this, I encourage you to go to the utilities website. The low impact development I find particularly really interesting in terms of how they're engineered, but then also I'm always surprised at how many of these that I see them around town as an installation of, you know, a very artistic sidewalk or something that I later learn is actually a low impact development feature. So I encourage you to go learn more about that. Now talking about water reclamation, this is really specific to water that's directed from homes and businesses into the wastewater collection system, and that is delivered to one of our two water reclamation facilities. The city has two reclamation facilities, the Mulberry and Drake facilities, that treat up to 23 million gallons of wastewater a day, and that comes from approximately 100,000 customers. And the goal here is to remove sediments, solids, nutrients, and pathogens. Discharges from our water treatment facilities after they've gone through the reclamation process, those are regulated under the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, another long acronym. We call that the MPDES permit and the Colorado Water Quality Control Act. Again, similar to water drinking water treatment, this is a highly regulated industry. So a number of chemical, physical, and biological processes are used in the reclamation process to meet water quality standards. And those standards are protective of aquatic life, recreation, and downstream water users on the Poudre River. Our two water reclamation facilities utilize what's called biological nutrient removal. So essentially, it means that these treatment facilities are living systems in which we have different types of microbes that are preferentially favored by the type and the amount of carbon that they are fed and the levels of oxygen that they receive. And that enhances the removal of different species of nitrogen and phosphorus at different stages of the treatment process. Very complex and very interesting process to learn about as well. But before that water can be returned to the environment, it's important to know we do have to test it and make sure it meets all the water quality standards that are protective of those beneficial uses, that life, recreation, and aquatic life, recreation, and downstream water uses. And also similar to the water treatment facility, the Water Reclamation Division benefits from having an on-site laboratory. We call this laboratory our Pollution Control Lab, or the PCL, and it provides water quality testing services for both the treatment facilities and a biosolids program that we have. The biosolids are the solid portion of the waste that is treated and removed from the during the wastewater treatment process, and they undergo further treatment, and then we own a ranch up near the Wyoming border called the Meadow Springs Ranch, and those biosolids are actually land applied up there as a fertilizer. So back to the lab, the PCL employs, similar to the water quality lab, we have 6 chemists and 1 lab assistant, a lab supervisor, and we share those quality assurance program team members with the water quality lab. Specifically, this lab provides analytical testing services that are supporting our discharge permits and other regulatory requirements, plant operations and optimization, Poudre River monitoring to make sure that the quality of the Poudre River is not impacted negatively above and below our wastewater outfalls, and any special studies that come up. So that was an overview of our water utilities related operations. And now I'm going to switch gears a bit, and I'm going to talk about some of the water quality challenges that we face and some of those emerging issues of concern. The first I'll talk about are harmful algal blooms. And these are of concern to the city due to their increasing prevalence and occurrence in urban water bodies that the city owns and manages for recreational use. Of particular concern are cyanobacteria and other harmful bacteria that can produce toxins that have a range of health effects on people or pets who come into contact with the water. These types of blooms can be driven by a number of factors, and they're very difficult to predict. But when you do see them, typically it's under conditions that are warm, the water temperature is warm, the water body is shallow, and there is not a lot of water replenishment. Either the flow is low or the waters are stagnant. Cyanobacteria and cyanotoxin monitoring plan. We had one in place and active on the city's source water supplies for many years now, with no positive occurrences recorded. This is most likely because waters that are coming out of Horsetooth and the Poudre are a combination of cold or deep or fast-moving water, so very different from the conditions that favor algal growth. In 2020, this issue was included, or the EPA included this set of contaminants, if you will, in their unregulated contaminants monitoring program, what we call the UCMR4. These were included just last year. We did not have any detections in our source or finished waters from that study. And then lastly on this topic, I'll mention there is a cross-departmental effort ongoing within the city to develop an urban lakes water quality management policy and guidance. Algal blooms are a central issue that prompted the discussions on how we go forward managing these lakes that had previously not required any type of management. So here we are back to the topic of emerging contaminants of emerging concern. So there are an increasing number of unregulated compounds that end up concentrated in our wastewater stream. And those, when we're talking about emerging contaminants, typically we're talking about things that include personal care products, hormones, pharmaceutical medications, herbicides, pesticides, and among other things. So those are typically very difficult to treat, and our wastewater treatment systems are not designed to remove them very effectively. And so they persist in the environment. In 2012, EPA, through the previous round of UCMR testing, they gathered data on several of the more notorious compounds that included things like perfluoroalkyl compounds. You might heard those called PFAs or PFOAs, also known as forever chemicals, due to their resistance and to treatment and their persistence in the environment. Fort Collins is very fortunate not to have any known sites or sources of these PFAs, those perfluoroalkyl substances. Do not know of any locations where those were used or manufactured within our watersheds, but we are downstream of wastewater facilities that deliver water out of Estes Park. And so wastewater streams can be a source of these compounds. And so we continue to monitor for the presence in Horsetooth Reservoir. Microplastics are also of interest and growing concern. So in addition to just being unpleasant and stressful, droughts intensify many of the problems that are already existing. Reduced flows provide less dilution for pollutants, causes challenges with our ability to discharge treated wastewater. It concentrates nutrients and the impacts of fire runoff. It also increases the likelihood of seeing those harmful algal blooms and the occurrence of those taste and odor compounds that I mentioned earlier. So coupled with population growth, drought intensifies the demand for these limited water supplies. And although I touched on impacts of wildfires earlier, I would be remiss not to include it in the list of these growing concerns and management challenges. Today, wildfires are burning larger, more frequently, and at higher intensity. And the after effects have both long and short-term effects on downstream water supplies. There are times where water supplies can even be rendered unusable for periods of time. And that can be for contamination reasons, or it can be the inability to access those supplies. Following the High Park fire in 2012, we were unable to access our Poudre River water supply for about 90 days because some of the power to the infrastructure actually was cut and had to be replaced. So in addition to some of these problems, the impacts, some of the water quality impacts, wildfire recovery efforts can be massively expensive. And funding sources, both federal and state sources, are stretched very thin. They are uncoordinated, meaning that one program does not necessarily dovetail or communicate with other programs. And there is not a clear path to acquiring these needed funds for the responding agencies. So changing regulations are just part of the nature of the business that we do here in utilities. However, most of the changes are resulting in tighter requirements, and they are often very costly to implement. Just a few examples of changes that are affecting us currently include a new proposed lead and copper rule that significantly increases the level of required sampling and reporting, among some other things. Particularly, they have a very, and rightfully so, a very intense focus on testing schools and daycares. So that would be a new requirement that we are exploring how to integrate into our existing operations. There is a total maximum daily load that was issued for E. coli. Essentially, this is when there is repeated violations on a water body over time. The state will intervene and issue what is called a TMDL, and that basically requires us to locate and identify the source. And in this case, we're looking for E. coli. What we're doing is we're trying to identify where E. coli is coming from, and we're also engaged in DNA testing to try to identify, is this coming from waterfowl, from mammals, or from humans? And we have been successful in identifying a few locations where we had unknown leaks in our wastewater system, and we were able to prioritize those for replacement. Surface water nutrient standards, those really challenge the limits of our wastewater technology. Currently, we're already investing tens of millions of dollars over the coming two decades in process improvements. And those improvements, if they perform at their, you know, their highest level, they will yield only very small increases in nutrient removal. So what we're seeing is that any improvements in removing nitrogen and phosphorus come with a very, very high price tag. And so lastly, I wanted to touch on our Utilities One Water initiative. Utilities One Water is, or One Water itself, is an integrated approach to managing water resources. And while it's not a new concept, it's becoming an increasingly important vehicle for moving away from the siloed approaches of the past. Water issues are always increasing in complexity, and they rarely affect only one discipline. So we're currently evaluating how we do business internally, and in order to reduce conflict and achieve some additional shared benefits. Collaboration is at the center of those efforts, and it requires us to really evaluate and reimagine, if you will, the business practices and processes that we use to ensure that our outcomes are not just serving our, you know, my needs, but also my neighboring department's needs, and so that we're able to provide, you know, a broader set of benefit for our community. So with that, that's the end of my prepared slides, and I'm happy to take any additional comments or questions.
So Jill, why don't you go ahead and take it off your screen? I do have one question, and since I, the professor, I get to ask first, and that is that in your One Water diagram, which I thought was a really neat way of displaying that, you talk about water reuse. And so what programs does Fort Collins have for water reuse? And, you know, what water quality concerns do you have to take into account for that?
This is not an area that I can speak to in very much detail. I just don't know a lot of the details. But currently, what I do know is that the City Council is considering gray water use in the system, and what is the feasibility of bringing gray water in. So by gray water, meaning untreated, untreated water. So are there ways that we can take, say, water from our homes that hasn't gone, that's not commingled with sewer water, and put that to use for irrigation or other non-consumable purposes. So I know that there's a little bit of headway being made, or at least discussion around the feasibility of incorporating gray water use, but at this point in time, I don't know of any programs specifically that are focused on reuse.
Thanks. What about rainwater barrels? How does Fort Collins approach that?
Again, this is a little bit outside of my area. This is really sort of the focus of our water conservation team. But as far as I know, rainwater collection systems are permitted in Fort Collins. And beyond that, I couldn't tell you a lot of details.
Okay, no, that's fine. But it gives me the opportunity to let people know that there is a state law on that, and you can have 255-gallon store 255 gallons of rainwater to use in your garden. So I wanted to mention that. Let me turn it over to students and see if they have any questions for you. Jill, that was a wonderful presentation. Thank you so much. Anyone else have some questions for?
Quick question.
Go ahead, CJ.
I believe you said when it came to source water quality effects after the Cameron Peak fire that your Horsetooth water supply was not really affected, and then there was only minor effects to the Poudre River supply. Is that correct?
Yeah, I may have misstated a little bit the impacts to the Poudre. The impacts to the Poudre are what I would call acute and severe. But as typically happens, you'll get a rain event and then you get sort of a flash flood effect that puts a pulse of material into the river. During those periods and within that surge of water, that the quality is degraded to, you know, a very severe extent, and it's unusable for our purposes at least. And so while the effect is intense, to what we have seen is that those impacts attenuate fairly rapidly following the storms moving through and returning to, in the absence of rain, the river will settle out or move on a lot of the material, and it allows us to start using the water quality or the water again.
Hey, yeah, I was curious because I had seen that Blackwater event photo, and I was surprised because I was like, if that didn't trigger an event that was considered substantial, I don't know what would. Are there any other, I guess, if that was, because it recovered so quickly, it's not considered a major concern. Have you encountered major concerns, and are there any concerns that you do, worry about? That just seemed like such a good opportunity for big concerns. And if it was really in the big picture, not that big a concern, I was just curious what could come up that would be of worry to you.
I guess to that, I would say, yes, certainly there are some additional concerns, but when we're describing that the impacts of one particular rain event, those are fairly acute and short-lived. So it is a considerable threat to water quality. We do avoid it at all costs, but they are over in anywhere from a few hours to several days is how long it takes us to go. It's really the number of events that we have that starts to impact our water supplies overall. So for instance, during the rainy season, early on in the monsoon season, we were seeing some pretty frequent rainstorms that were turning the water black. And it was persisting for numerous days in a row because the rains just kept coming. So in that event, we were in a position where we could turn off the intake for however long it required us and switch over to Horsetooth water supplies. Where the real concerns come in are, had the drought conditions continued to intensify, and had we not had as sufficient water supplies in Horsetooth as we had this year, we may be faced with a situation where the Poudre is impacted and we don't have the water, the right to the water in Horsetooth Reservoir to go off of the Poudre River entirely. So in those situations, we would be looking at a more severe situation where we're only using perhaps a little bit of Horsetooth to blend down some of those problems, or having to bring that sediment-laden water into our pipelines. 14 miles of pipelines over hill and dale, you can imagine that a lot of material will drop out, and you end up with the plugs of material in your pipelines that anytime that those get into the water treatment facility can have some pretty significant and serious implications for treatment and potentially cause us not to be able to deliver that water. So that is a situation we try to avoid at all costs, is getting any type of, bad water into our pipelines. So that is a significant concern in the event that we don't have adequate supplies to switch off. The other one is, what's the long-term impacts of those sediments that are being deposited into the upstream reservoirs? Like I mentioned earlier, those can have some longer-term water quality impacts that we just haven't seen or experienced, so it's an unknown for us. And then lastly, anytime that you get these surges of material being put into the river, what happens is they find these depositional areas in the river, they settle out, and you get these large banks of sediments that accumulate on the shores of the river. If you've driven up, you've probably seen some of them. So what that means in a system that is highly regulated by reservoir water deliveries is that anytime water is released upstream, regardless of whether there's a rainfall event or not, anytime the water level in the river changes, that in turn produces a flashier system. It picks up and resuspends those sediments. So the system overall becomes much more flashy and sensitive to changes from releases or storms. And so, again, that plays into, you know, how often we can go on and off of the Poudre River.
Great. Elsa, did you have your hand up? Okay. Any other questions?
We had a couple questions in the chat.
Okay.
First, we Abdul Kakim said, thank you for the very informative presentation. If I heard correctly, 65 million gallons of treated water are given to Fort Collins and only 23 million gallons of wastewater arrive in the treatment facilities. Is all the rest of the water used irrevocably?
This kind of gets into the water accounting side of things, and I'm not going to be able to definitively answer, you know, sort of the accounting of where all the water goes. Some of that water, some potable water currently is used for irrigation. So some of the water is consumed. Some of the water is return flow through groundwater percolation and back into the river. We also have the service areas for our water and wastewater are slightly different in size and configuration. And so we have several what are called, they're just smaller collection systems. So we have smaller wastewater collectors that will either bring water to our Fort Collins facility or they'll take them to South Fort Collins. That's another water treatment facility that's just downstream of us. So the accounting on how many customers we serve on the top end is not necessarily equal how much comes out on the wastewater end. So I think that's a couple of the pieces that hopefully gets a little bit to the answer to the question.
Another question in the chat?
Yes. So next we have Lee was saying he or she might ask.
Bill, thank you very much for that presentation. You know, it was nice to hear, and also interesting to hear your response to the rain events causing the black water and so on, and that is a sporadic short term. Just how many days were you offline from the Poudre this summer, compared to the High Park fire, which was 90 days? And then second, you talked about the sedimentation issue, and my understanding is you built a $2 million sedimentation capture system after the High Park fire. And you're worried about sedimentation in the reservoirs, of course, but have you seen much evidence of sedimentation either in the reservoirs or in your sedimentation capture basin, whatever you installed after the High Park fire, if that's correct?
So time off the reservoir, time off of the river, excuse me. So, we were, off of the river for 92 days, but as I also mentioned, part of the reason that we were off continuously for that amount of time was not due to the quality of water in the river at the time. It was due to the fact that we couldn't access or power our water taking, facility. And so some of those sort of factors that were driving those 93 days are commingled with between infrastructure issues and a few storm events that we did have. So it's a little bit difficult to tease out and compare apples to apples just because I haven't done it. But this time around, I don't have a good count on how many days we were off the river this summer, but we were definitely off for several weeks in a row. I would say 2 to 3 weeks at the beginning of the summer. We also have been off and on for rain events, probably 6 to 10 times And those have varied anywhere from, like I was mentioning, a couple days to a mere couple hours. And really what determines that is how severe is the event itself. So I don't have a good answer, Lee, for, you know, how does last High Park compare to this time around? I just haven't dug into the information, the data yet to give that answer. But to your question about the pre-sedimentation basin, so we did build, after High Park Fire, we built a what's called a pre-sedimentation basin, and it enabled us to go from 1 to 2. So it increased our capacity to take some of that sediment-laden water, slow it down, and decant off of the top and have some of that sediment sink to the bottom, essentially. So the way that we use that system, it has to be pre-planned. And so we do use it, and we found that it has about a 50% effectiveness rate, or so essentially it'll take out about 50% of the sediment. So it performs very much on par with our other systems, but we have not, again, we haven't been in a position where we've had to utilize it. That is a system where if we were needing to treat some of that more marginal water quality, we would push some of that water into that pre-sedimentation basin to increase, you know, basically the settling time before we put it into our pipelines. But you're right, that would be a major protection in that would keep us from getting a lot of sediment in our pipelines if we were forced into that type of situation.
So I've asked, one of our staff members, Julie Kallenberger, has put in, and Molly has transferred to the chat, a couple of documents you might be interested in with respect to rainwater collection and also the initial observations of the Black Hollow debris flow. So those references are in the chat if you want to look at that. Are there any final questions for Jill?
We have 3 more questions in the chat if we have time.
Jill, are you game?
All right. First one is, how far downstream does the black water persist after a rainstorm?
That's a good question. It's not something that I have, I've actually monitored. I know that, so I have 2 offices, one being on the upstream end of our water system and the other at our water reclamation facility, which is out on Environmental Drive near Ziegler and Timberline. Kind of area. So what I can tell you is that anytime we see a black water event, we see similar water quality come through here. So I know that it persists at least through town and most likely into the what we call the lower Poudre, past I-25 reaches. The river really flattens out and slows down as it kind of hits the plains. And so I would anticipate, just a guess, I would anticipate that a lot of the sediment starts to drop out as you get into the reaches between Fort Collins and Windsor and Greeley.
Okay, perfect. The next question is from Tom. He asks, are chemicals used in firefighting, just knocked off the screen. Are chemicals used in firefighting a concern?
So particularly for wildfires, they use what is called PhosCheck, and it's a slurry of ammonium phosphate, which is ammonia and phosphorus, 2 nutrients, and it includes iron oxide that's a colorant, along with probably a couple other additives. But what that does is it smothers the fire, and it leaves behind nutrients that can foster regrowth in the system. It does not contain any perfluorocarbon substances, or PFAS as they're known. Type 2 firefighting foams are the only types that have in the past contained the PFAS. And what those are used for are liquid flammable fires, and very specific types of structural fire. So they're very specialized and rarely used. So we did a source water protection plan, and we worked with PFA, or in this case, Poudre Fire Authority. We inventoried all the sources and storage locations for any types of firefighting foams. And first of all, they don't use any type B firefighting foams, and there's no other known manufacturer storage of those materials within our watersheds.
Great. Was there one more question?
Yep. The last question is, would you know if the unusable water containing sediment from fires continue downstream towards other counties to then be treated?
I would say that any of the water that's bypassed most certainly is available for whatever downstream users as they pick it up. You know, just to be clear, folks like, you know, City of Greeley, they collect their water at the same location we do in the canyon. So some of the larger communities either get their water from all other sources, or they collect it in the canyon mouth like we do. So off the top of my head, I cannot think of a community on regionally in the Northern Front Range that collects their drinking water off of the Poudre significantly downstream of us.
And just so you all remember, I think in October we have City of Greeley talking to us a little bit about some of their water projects. Jill, you have been a champ in staying over for us. Thank you so much. That was just an interesting, fascinating discussion and presentation. I can't thank you enough. Next week, we're going to talk about how conservation of land and water benefit ecosystems. I have Carmen Farmer from Colorado Open Lands coming. So we look forward to seeing you next week. And again, Jill, thanks so much, Jill. Have a good evening.
Thank you very much. Just for the record in the conversation, Sean Chambers from Greeley provided an answer about the downstream fire impacted water, if you're interested.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Thank you. I didn't see that.
Jill.
Thank you. See y'all. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.